This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 30th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 389. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and on the big deal feature, at the end of the first quarter of 2025, the MMA panel returns. 1 week into the federal election, less than a week until the by-election in the city of Vancouver, and almost a month after the provincial budget that landed with a thud. Joining me are Mario Canseco of Research Co. and Andy Yan of the Simon Fraser University City Program. It all starts after this.
This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast.
It's time for the MMA panel. That's me, Mackin. The other M is Mario Canseco of Research Co. And the A, as in Andy, is Andy Yan, the director of the Simon Fraser University City Program. Last time we got together on the Breaker.News podcast, Joe Biden was in his final weeks as president of the United States of America. We didn't know it at the time, but Justin Trudeau was just days away from announcing his resignation as prime minister. And here we are in a federal election with Mark Carney and the Liberals using the Doug Ford Ontario playbook against the Pierre Poilievre Conservatives. Liberals want to talk about Trump and the future of Canada. Poilievre wants to talk about 9 years of Liberal waste, corruption, and incompetence.
Mario Canseco, where do we see this campaign going? As the podcast comes out after the first week, there'll be another 4 weeks or so. A lot can happen along the way in the campaign trail. There still are the debates to happen. Where do you see this going as the trade war has taken off to become the number one issue?
Well, the Liberals are benefiting from the trade war. There's no two ways about it. Now we have 30% of Canadians who say it's the number one issue facing the country. The over 55 voter is more likely to feel this way and also more likely to say that they're voting for the Liberals. So that explains the last couple of days, the efforts of the Conservatives to talk to seniors by offering a free tax-free savings account, some certain changes to the fiscal policy. They need to get that demographic back. It's a demographic that used to vote for the Conservatives under Stephen Harper, but doesn't anymore. I think the main surprise of the first week is how quickly the center-left forces have galvanized around Carney. The level of support for the NDP is in single digits. They haven't had numbers this low in a quarter century when Alexa McDonough was their leader. The Greens are at a threshold that would not guarantee participation in the televised debate for Jonathan Bernot. And we also have people who usually are hardcore sovereignists in Quebec saying it might be worth our while to ensure that the country we want to secede from exists. So we're going to vote for the Liberals this time. Usually you have this movement in the final 3 or 4 days of the campaign, not in the first 3 or 4. So we could be in a situation where the Liberals peak too early and the Conservatives come back, or the numbers just keep climbing as people start to get to know Mark Carney.
Andy Yan, is Mark Carney for real? I mean, I'm not sensing Carney mania like there was Trudeau mania 2.0 in 2015. Carney is a rookie to federal campaigns. Poilievre is really the pro. He's been practicing for this for the last couple of years. Here we have Mark Carney, who is an economist and corporate titan, you know, Brookfield Asset Management, his previous job, a $1 trillion company that helped Elon Musk buy Twitter, and the company that has invested in China, for instance. Is this just a lot of hype, a lot of sizzle around the state?
Well, he is the image that comes up if you ask ChatGPT, give me an image of a Canadian banker who is running for prime minister. And that is what, and he is at least that image now of what that, what could be a generative artificial intelligence construct. And I think that it's really rolling into, I think, the how Canadians are feeling at this moment, not necessarily by the enthusiasm or the charm of any of the particular federal leaders, but as a serious anger, fear, and concern about what's coming out of the United States, that I think the feeling that we are in an existential crisis in terms of who we are as Canadians, I think has really changed the entire environment, as Mario has touched upon, in terms of what the major issues are and what Canadians see as leadership. But then at the same time, it's not particularly arenas, if you were to take the issues before Donald Trump, there hasn't been really dramatic changes in towards public policy or innovations around particular issues like, well, housing in particular. So I think that this is really going to be, I think, something that in one way isn't based upon the individual candidates themselves, but really how Canadians feel about what's happening south of the border and who has the reputation or the potential they feel who's going to provide the adequate response.
The carbon tax is gone as of April 1st. That was one of the few major decisions Mark Carney made in his short time as prime minister before dropping the election writs. He's gone and appointed some star candidates. One of them, no stranger to Vancouverites, Gregor Robertson, who appears to be getting ready to be Stephen Guilbeault 2.0. If the Liberals stay in power, he would make a case for being the environment minister. I mean, Mario Canseco, do you think voters have such a short memory span that, you know, this mayor who was so divisive while in office, who left office again with such a negative legacy, can try to make a comeback and try to ride this Liberal wave?
I think the wave might be enough to carry even people without name recognition. We go back to 2015, and the Liberals were able to win the sitting mission, which was quite a surprise. It's part of what happens when the vote coalesces around somebody. And what I find deliciously ironic is 6 months ago, you couldn't find anybody to run for the Liberals in many seats. You know, kudos to somebody like Wade Grant, who said, "I want to run in Quadra," and was there before Justin Trudeau stepped down. There's other candidates who were part of the nomination process way before. And now you have people lining up because they want to be part of what seems to be the next government of the country. And 6 months ago, you had a lot of conservatives who were lining up to run behind Pierre Poilievre. I think they've made some quite wacky decisions when it comes to people of experience, such as Mike DeYoung or Anita Huberman in Surrey, who certainly bring the gravitas that the candidates that he's trying to portray as salt of the earth just don't have with them. The man they're running instead of Mike DeYoung finished in, I believe, 20th place out of 28 council candidates in the township of Langley. It really makes me believe that the only reason why they're doing this is because they don't want anybody out there with more experience than Poilievre. And this is why they're grabbing candidates from all sorts of walks of life. I don't think he wanted to be in the same room with somebody like Anita Huberman, who's actually run the Board of Trade, or like Mike DeYoung, who has been a minister. So it's a significant shift. Now you have a lot of people thinking, hell, I might run for the Liberals in the island and maybe I'll get a seat.
Do you think that David Eby is potential leadership material federally with the forecasts that unless things change, Jagmeet Singh is not going to increase the NDP seat count, but probably it'll decrease?
I would answer with a television, American television reference. Let's say the NDP is the Tonight Show, and the Tonight Show that was not given to David Letterman is very different than the Tonight Show that was ultimately left by Jay Leno. If the NDP is the Tonight Show, there may not be a Tonight Show after April 28th. If the numbers for the NDP continue to drop, if we have a situation where the center-left vote continues to favor the Liberals. Do you want to leave your job as the head of government of a province to take over a caucus which might actually be in single digits? Again, you know, 6 months ago, maybe it would have been a great idea. And you know that they rarely get their leaders three kicks at the can. One that I was lucky enough to have, that was Jack Layton, and it worked out wonderfully back in 2011 for the NDP due to Michael Ignatieff's leadership of the Liberals. But, you know, there may not even be an NDP by the time this is done. I think that is part of the complexity here. All this talk about us becoming the 51st state,
right?
The politics, we're already looking like it. All the minor parties are in single digits, the same way that it happens with the Libertarians and the Greens in the United States. So I don't think it makes any sense for David Eby, who, thanks to the complexities of the BC Conservatives and the fact that they've lost three members of their caucus, who might actually establish some sort of Freedom Party down the road. He has a long runway, and there will always be an opportunity to blame Trump for things. But that has a sort of expiration date. You know, 6 months from now, a year from now, you're going to have to start paying attention again to the problems that people have in the province, mainly housing and the economy and jobs.
Andy, yeah, do you think that's going to be the way it'll go, that the Liberals will turn into the Democrats and the Conservatives will turn into Republicans North, and the NDP will just kind of fold in along with the labor sector, fold into the Liberal coalition? Do you think that's the way it's going?
Well, that's the interesting issue here, is really how Pierre Poilievre with the Conservative Party has been attempting to go for the hearts and minds of Canadian workers, and how the NDP, through its various initiatives, have actually alienated a good hunk of the of its traditional base with union workers. And I think that this is really going to be a interesting election to kind of see that those types of realignments and really the kind of shifts in terms of how labor sees itself, whether it sees itself as liberal or whether it sees itself as part of this kind of dissatisfaction about the existing status quo in Canada. I think that this is really, I think a lot of this is going to be about the really about the how well or how badly Canada deals with the tariffs and the kind of implications of what it means in terms of the economic crisis. But then also, you know, let's face it, there's going to be concerns around national security, around national identity, through which I think is an open, it's an open call. But yet it's really coming down to really how Poilievre was dedicated towards a campaign against Justin Trudeau, and how that's completely disappeared. And now he deals with an opponent who he's tried to kind of reshape into a Justin Trudeau who really isn't, and who is, I think, taken on really the kind of spirit of a much more, well, I mean, of the progressive conservative. And I think that it's a very kind of unique moment in Canadian political history, where this is perhaps how the Liberals become progressive conservatives, as opposed to how it was, say, the Liberals under Justin Trudeau. And I think that this is really, I think, the type of positioning through which Pierre Poilievre is not ready to engage, that he isn't. And I think that, you know, as we were talking earlier before, the operatives that, you know, from Mike DeYoung in particular, but Anita Huberman specifically, it was surprising to see how Anita Huberman wasn't even being considered for a candidacy. And I think it's also then, of course, one also has to mention how Christy Clark had considered a position with the Liberals. And I think between Christy Clark and Mike DeYoung, they basically had more luggage than YVR during a snowstorm. And that type of luggage was seen as political liabilities between the Conservatives and the Liberals, I think, through which have produced an environment through which I think that will, I think the chances of a liberal, probably small majority government that is probably governing more as a progressive conservative party back in the day, I think is becoming apparent.
And that by-election is coming up very quickly, April the 5th. To fill the seats vacated by Christine Boyle, who went to David Eby's cabinet, and Adrian Carr, who decided to retire from politics. Mario Canseco, where do you think that this by-election is going to go?
It's so hard to tell, you know, even for people in my industry, when you have a voter turnout that is as wild as it can get in a by-election, it becomes very complicated to talk about this with numbers. I think there's a couple of elements at play. One of them is obviously the problems with incumbents. Gensim got elected on a everything is broken platform, and many things remain broken, so that's complicated for the base that came out in support, and it wasn't massive. You know, we had a voter turnout in that election of 36%. That being said, the name of the game in municipal elections, and particularly in by-elections, is identifying your base and getting it out. If they have a good list of people, if you still have, let's say, out of the 51% of voters that supported Gensim, if you still have about 30% of them on a good list and you're going to call them and get them out to vote, then it's an advantage because the other parties just can't compete with that. For the Greens, it's a moment of reckoning. We've always had a situation where Adrienne Carr finishes in first place because she gets the support of the Green base, which definitely exists, but also the final vote of the center-left or center-right voter. You know, you vote GOPE, you vote One City, you vote Vision, and you give your last vote to Adrienne. Or you voted for the NPA or for ABC and you wanted to have a Green voice there, so you gave your last vote to Adrienne. They need to get their first vote or second vote to Annette Riley. So that's a complicated aspect for the Greens. You have the candidacies of One City and GOPE, which can also be competitive. You have team running two candidates, which is interesting because they want to corral those two seats. But you also minimize the opportunity of somebody looking at Colleen or at Abbott as somebody who would be your second choice. Let's say you want to send them a mixed message by saying, I like the Green and I like one of the teams, but not the other. So that could also play a role in the way the numbers are moving. But the other thing I would say is by-elections mean very little in the grand scheme of things. You know, we were there in 2012 when the NDP won two seats, one of them with Gwen O'Mahony, who now has become a conservative. The other one was Port Moody, and everybody said, you know, the wave is there and the election of 2013 is going to be a massive blowout. And the BC Liberals ended up winning both of those seats back. So let's not read too much into what happens in a by-election. That's what Hector Bremner did, and it didn't end well for him.
And you got to remember, it was 11% in the last by-election in 2016 that elected Hector Bremner. 17. And, you know, there was a moment through which you thought that Hector Bremner and Yes Vancouver was this transformative party through which would sweep and take over civic politics. And it didn't. And I think that that's really the characteristic of, well, civic by-elections, is that it is really about getting the vote out and who is more effective. I think part of it is really the sizable changes within each of these civic parties. You have to remember that the ABC, it was under Lam that was able to kind of run an incredible ground game, and now that he's out, far out of ABC, the question is whether there is that kind of strategist who knows what's happening locally, knows who to call to kind of bring out the vote. But similarly, I think one of the interesting things about what's happening with the Greens as well as One City, it's actually around generational change, meaning the first generation of successful politicians have now left. That Adrienne Carr was one of the original folks who got the Greens into the civic into City Hall in Vancouver, as well as Christine Boyle. And now it's whether that second generation can come on in. We saw parallels to this in terms of Vision, that second generation Vision didn't make it. So, and I think it resulted in some ongoing sizable changes. But then again, going back to how municipal by-elections aren't necessarily a thermometer of change as much as a example of satisfaction or dissatisfaction. I wonder if Colleen Hardwick, with her brand recognition, because of what she was, a former council member, as well as I think at least within certain parts of social media, certainly I think quite prevalent in terms of taking positions, whether she has an extra chance and whether that will spread out to someone like Theodore Abbott and to bring him in. But similarly, I think, you know, it would be curious to kind of see whether Sean Orr from Coke is able to resurrect a brand of in Vancouver's political history back in there. And if Sean Orr can perhaps summon the spirit of Harry Rankin to be that voice of the left in Vancouver City Council. And if folks can remember Harry Rankin and the position him into this. But again, I think it's all about turnout. It's all about that ground game just to get the vote out for this particular by-election.
The elephant in the room, as we go towards this civic by-election, as we have this federal election, it, with the trade war in the background, is the FIFA World Cup 26. Our governments of Canada, Mexico should be collaborating right now with the United States to plan for this tournament, June and July of 2026, the biggest single sport event in history. But we have Donald Trump in the White House. So should the World Cup matches of 2026 be a bargaining chip? And should Canada, should Vancouver and Toronto say no thank you, but no thank you, and exercise the force majeure clause in their contracts?
I don't see the mayors of either city doing it. I think it would send a very powerful message. You know, Russia has been kicked out of most sports competitions. If they had invaded Ukraine prior to the 2018 World Cup, it would have been a completely different situation. We had a boycott of the 1980 games after the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. And here we have one of the three partners jokingly or not so jokingly referring to one of them as the 51st state. So it would be an opportunity to send a significant message of dismay at what is happening with Donald Trump. I'm sure he would be happy to have the games and to claim that this is something that is taking place because of his magnificent negotiating skills. But I think the other complexity is what it does to the program. Let's say for the sake of argument, you send the games back. Does Canada still qualify, or is Canada now kicked out of the World Cup because it's no longer one of the hosts? It's just too complicated. What really worries me about this is the level of preparedness of the city to deal with the influx of fans. And right. I'm not talking about a Canada match versus whoever we get in the two games that Canada is playing. But if we get a Serbia, if we get an England, if we get a team from a Muslim majority nation that plays one match in Seattle and one match in Vancouver, with everything that is happening with Donald Trump, things could get really complicated.
Right. Metro Vancouver, a year ago, they dropped a bombshell on that Friday afternoon in the middle of spring break to say that the North Shore Wastewater Treatment Plant was going to cost almost $4 billion, a $3 billion cost overrun, and it won't be ready till 2030, which is a decade after it was supposed to be ready. They've hired Peter Milburn, a former deputy minister, deputy finance minister, deputy transportation minister in the BC government, to look into the North Shore Wastewater Treatment Plant. Well, we do know that he really doesn't have any power. He doesn't have power to subpoena documents or compel testimony. This isn't the public inquiry that so many were demanding. The North Shore Neighborhoods Alliance was demanding a public inquiry. Councillors in other municipalities, you know, in New Westminster, it was Daniel Fontaine. In Richmond, it was Cash Heed, demanding a public inquiry to get to the bottom of this. We're not going to get that. Andy Yan, do you think that Peter Milburn is going to get to the bottom of anything with the work that he's been entrusted to do by Metro Vancouver on the North Shore Wastewater Treatment Plant scandal?
Unfortunately not. I think that there is a larger question of governance of the overall regional government of Metropolitan Vancouver. And this wastewater treatment plant in the North Shore is really just a pregame show of the $10 billion Iona Island project, that I think that this is going to leave some profound challenges in terms of how decisions are made for these regional facilities, that you can only do these facilities on a regional basis. It's just, how do you do them with a level of competency, of transparency and action through which makes these projects happen? I mean, part of it is also acknowledging that how we build these facilities have changed a lot over the last 50 years, that even in the last 20 years, we don't dump raw sewage in the Strait of Georgia anymore. I hear we're in a earthquake zone, through which adds additional challenges and demands on things, on critical infrastructure like wastewater and water in general. And I think that this is really an ongoing problem that won't be resolved by just one commission, that the fact that every additional housing unit that we add to our region at minimum costs $150,000. That's a statistic coming out of the Canadian Urban Institute that we are still desperately trying to figure out how to pay for. But yet, at the same time, we have a system that is quickly aging out, that is really outside of its service age, through which we need to figure out a system through which we'll pay for not necessarily even upgrades, but just maintenance of existing services. So I think that this is really a call for larger changes in terms of regional governance and just how those services are going to be provided. Because I don't think let's make septic fields great again is really a good idea in terms of how we deal with these large regional wide facilities that we need as a fast growing region.
Mario Canseco of Research Co and Andy Yan of the Simon Fraser University City Program, thanks again for joining us.
News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In FocusTaiwan.tw, Premier issues warning after mob bosses try to hold event at legislature. Premier Cho Jung-tai warned after news broke that the Bamboo Union, one of Taiwan's largest organized crime networks, had planned to meet at the Legislative Yuan's Gangwon restaurant to select a new leader. The spaces for 35 members of the gang's leadership were reportedly booked by Chinese Unification Promotion Party founder Chang An-le, who is also known as White Wolf. Cho instructed the Interior Ministry and National Police Agency to investigate. In Hong Kong Free Press, Hong Kong's security chief has again slammed Ming Pao after the newspaper ran an editorial defending a reporter who asked the official why his trip to Thailand earlier this month went unannounced. And a Chinese influencer left Taiwan on Tuesday after her residency permit was revoked for advocating that China unify the island by military means. In ABC News Australia, thousands leave New Caledonia in civil unrest as long recovery awaits those staying. Months of violence, which ignited over attempted electoral reforms, led to 13 deaths and deepened divisions in New Caledonia over the question of independence from France. It also left a trail of economic carnage, destroyed businesses, job losses, and a weak economy. Almost 11,000 mostly French nationals left the territory of 270,000 in 2024. In Kyoto News, Japan demands exemption from U.S. auto tariffs. Japanese automakers have made direct investments into the United States worth around $61.6 billion U.S. dollars and created around 2.3 million jobs, said Chief Cabinet Secretary Yoshimasa Hayashi. Meanwhile, Japan draws up a plan to evacuate 120,000 Okinawa Islanders near Taiwan. With tensions between China and Taiwan escalating, Japan is planning drills in 2026.
That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In Willamette Week, Portland journalist researched how cults exploit spirituality for Blazing Eye Sees All. Leah Sodal's new book explores the subculture of New Age ideologies American vulnerability and the deep history of the grift, spiritual vacancy in every case, appeared a throughway for those professing divine powers to indoctrinate followers and fleece them in the process. In King 5, Mariners debut colorful corn dog dessert nachos for 2025 season food offerings. The What Up Corn Dog is a Mariners blue, honey-battered corn dog with a spicy crunch, served with nacho cheese. In honor of Hall of Famer Ichiro Suzuki, the Ichiro Roll, with salmon, crab salad, avocado, cucumber, green onion, fried onion, sriracha, rice, and seaweed. And then there are the Ichi Wings. Mariners star catcher Cal Raleigh will have Little Dumplers. Based on his Big Dumper nickname, these pork soup dumplings will come with sesame and hoisin sauce. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. Exclusive video shows arrest of BC man accused of carjacking in Richmond and crashing through U.S. border. And Vancouver mayor who fostered cozy ties with Chinese Communist Party becomes Carney Liberal candidate. Read the stories behind these headlines. Go to thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com.
That's Cascadia calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand alone.
The Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the Canadian Red Cross and its volunteers. From first aid to emergency and disaster training and response, they do it all. Founded in 1896, March is Red Cross Month in Canada. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob at thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 30th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 30th of March in 1959, Tenzin Gyatso, the 14th Dalai Lama, fled Tibet for India? And on the 30th of March in 1981, President Ronald Reagan survived an assassination attempt in Washington, D.C. Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob at thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Visit me there too. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News as news happens on X, formerly Twitter. You can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com.
Until next week.